Thank you very much, Rabbi Weissman. It's a pleasure to be here and to address you this morning. In general, secular law very much supports the arbitration process and motivating people to feel comfortable about utilizing arbitration tribunals to settle their disputes. In fact, it was a recent Supreme Court case, Henry Schein versus Archer and White Sales, which was a unanimous decision of the Supreme Court, the first decision that was authored by the new Justice of the Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh, who I think went to Yale Law School the same time that I did. And that decision affirmed the general preference that the secular law has with respect to the arbitration process and the respect that it has towards arbitration agreements and towards the authority of the arbitrators. So the starting point question is what we do with the general state of the law that gives tremendous authority to arbitration panels, and the fact that at the same time there are secular laws that are generally applied when either a court of law of competent jurisdiction meets to adjudicate a case, or most arbitration tribunals. Because most arbitration tribunals will generally look at the secular law as well to guide them with respect to their decision making. And a basic premise of the Beit Din, of the rabbinical tribunal, is that even though it is an arbitration tribunal under secular law, the parties are agreeing to a process which is distinctly in contradiction to secular law, namely a Jewish law process, that the parties agree they're going to go to a Jewish law tribunal that's going to decide the case in accordance with the Jewish laws. It does the respect that the secular law gives towards arbitration tribunals in general, it does that encompass respect for a situation where the parties say that they want to be governed by an entirely different system of law, by Jewish law. And to what degree does the arbitration tribunal have an obligation to take into account secular law considerations in addition to Jewish law considerations? And to what degree, under the principles of Jewish law, does the arbitration tribunal even have the right to take into account secular law considerations in addition to Jewish law considerations? One of the general categories that is sometimes cited for grounds that would enable a court to overturn a decision that was rendered by an arbitration tribunal is what is sometimes referred to as manifest disregard of law. I think that in the New York arbitration statutes, the way it's codified is that an arbitrator would have to manifestly exceed a specifically enumerated limitation on the arbitrator's power. So the way that it's formulated, I believe in New York civil laws, really answers the question, which is that it's not really a manifest disregard of law if the parties themselves have not limited the arbitrator's power in that fashion to authorize the arbitrator to only decide according to civil law. The parties have said, we understand that we're submitting to a Beit Din, we're submitting to a rabbinical tribunal that's going to decide the case according to Jewish law. If you look at the standard arbitration agreement of the Beit Din of America, I believe that it says explicitly that the Beit Din is going to decide the case according to Jewish law principles and principles of equity and compromise consistent with Jewish law, what we call Peshara Krova L'Din. So the parties understand that this is the standard of law. There still is what we call the completely irrational standard. If any arbitration tribunal would issue a decision that a court would deem to be completely irrational, then it can still overturn the Beit Din's decision. But as the court stated in a famous Long Island case involving a Long Island yeshiva and a rebbe who taught in that Long Island yeshiva, the case is brought down in 70 AD 3rd, 935, from the year 2010. The court, in upholding a decision of the Beit Din of America that a lower court judge had originally overturned because the lower court judge had ruled that it was completely irrational. The appellate court said that the completely irrational standard requires that it be a decision where there is no proof whatever to justify the award. And as long as there is proof to justify the award, certainly your standard Jewish law decision has proof and has a basis to articulate the final award and decision that is meted out by the Beis Din, then it will be upheld, and therefore the appellate division upheld the decision of the Beit Din in that particular case. But sometimes you have what's called strong public policy limitations, that there are public policy reasons why a particular arbitrator's decision will not be upheld. If the civil court comes to the conclusion that under secular law, the public policy considerations for there being a different resolution are so compelling that the arbitrator's award cannot stand. Now, this really takes two different forms, the public policy exceptions. One form is that there are sometimes types of cases where either there's statutory law or there is decisional law, which have concluded that there are certain types of disputes that are not subject as a matter of public policy to enforceable arbitration. For example, in the state of New York, there's a case called Glauber versus Glauber, 1600 New York State, page 740, a 1993 decision, in which the court concluded that child custody determinations cannot be enforceable when submitted to arbitration. Parties can go to an arbitrator, they can go to a Beit Din, and the Beit Din can issue an award, but if either side does not want to comply with the award, the other side, then that side would have an easy time going to court and saying, look, this wasn't subject to enforceable arbitration, I want another bite at the apple, I want to be able to re-adjudicate this in civil court. That's one type of a public policy limitation. Interestingly, in New Jersey, that's not the law. New Jersey, there's a case called Forsey versus Forsey, 199, New Jersey, page 456 from 2009. It was reaffirmed in a later case called Johnson versus Johnson, in which the New Jersey courts came to the conclusion that even child custody cases can be adjudicated in front of an arbitration tribunal, so long as the arbitration tribunal follows the standard of the best interest of the children. So even if it is in front of a Beit Din, it can be an enforceable decision. That's one type of limitation. There's a second type of limitation, which is where the law states that as a public policy matter, a type of case can be arbitrated in front of an arbitration tribunal, but if the arbitration tribunal does not show that it followed the standard required by the law in adjudicating its decision, then the decision can be thrown out because of very strong public policy considerations. What type of case falls into that category? Child support. If there's a divorce case and the Beis Din is not deciding child custody, the courts feel that's we have the principle of parens patriae. The courts are the guardians of the children, nobody else. So they won't even consider that to be enforceable if the best interest of the child standard is followed. But you also have child support cases where the courts say, as long as the child support standards guidelines have been followed by the arbitration tribunal. For example, if it's a Beis Din, the Beis Din shows that it took into consideration the different percentage requirements of the child support standards guidelines, so then the decision of the Beit Din will be deemed enforceable. So the question is, to what degree do these types of considerations, public policy limitations, things of that sort, to what degree do they impact upon the Din Torah proceeding and the way that it is conducted? You should know that despite the limitation of enforceability upon child custody cases, the Beit Din of America hears child custody cases all the time. So you say, how can it do such a thing? Because it engages in what might be referred to as collaborative arbitration. Collaborative arbitration is where there's an understanding among the parties that even though the arbitrators are going to issue a decision, the parties are going to collaborate to make sure that they come together in reaching that decision. It's not quite a mediation where the parties just reach an agreement on their own, but it's sort of like a mediation. The parties say, if we can't reach an agreement on their own, we agree that we will accept the Bezdin's decision, even if it's not enforceable, and they work together with the lawyers. We trust the Bezdin process, the child custody experts and therapists who are used by the Bezdin. We trust this process. We're not going to go through the whole process again. It'll probably reach the same result anyway. And therefore, once the Bezdin issues its decision, the lawyers will work together with the parties in terms of incorporating the decision of the Bezdin into a comprehensive divorce settlement agreement signed by the parties. And once you have a comprehensive divorce settlement agreement signed by the parties, then that will be capable of enforcement by a court. What about in the child support context? Do we say that once the court says that they have a strong public policy rule that an arbitration decision will only be enforceable if the arbitration tribunal takes into account the civil law requirements of the child support standards guidelines, is that something that is binding upon the Bezdin? Not as a matter of civil law. We understand as a matter of civil law, it will impact on enforceability. But as a matter of Jewish law, do we say that that becomes binding upon the Bezdin so that the Bezdin must follow that standard? When it comes to child custody determinations, the Bezdin anyway follows the general standard of best interests of the children, which is why, even if it would be relitigated in court, as long as since the Bezdin uses really top-notch experts, we're not really worried that it would lead to a different result. And I think that's the reason why there's never been a child custody decision handed down by the Bezdin, to the best of my knowledge, that has been challenged in civil court. It has always been incorporated by the parties and their lawyers into a divorce settlement agreement. So there really are three different areas in which one can question whether Jewish law actually incorporates or allows for the incorporation of secular law into the Jewish law judicial process. One is when the parties make a tanai, as Rabbi Weissman had mentioned. The parties make a condition that they want the Bezdin to adjudicate their case, their dispute, in accordance with secular law. A second example, which Rabbi Weissman also alluded to, is minag ha-sochrin, where you have a custom of the marketplace. It could be that the parties didn't necessarily make an explicit condition that they want their case decided according to secular law, but in their industry, everybody does things a certain way. The architectural industry, the diamond industry, everybody does things a certain way, and it happens to be consistent with a secular law. So do you say that since this is the minhag, it's the custom, so it automatically becomes applicable as a matter of halacha, of Jewish law, despite the fact that its foundation is in secular law? And the third category is the dina de malchusa dina, that we have a principle that is found a few times in the Talmud, articulated by Shmuel, who is one of the sages of the Talmud. It says, dina de malchusa dina, that the law of the land is the law. Now, this is not an all-encompassing principle. If it would be an all-encompassing principle, we would have no reason to sit and learn Torah law in the context of Bet Din proceedings. We would just follow secular law. But that's not the case. It's not an all-encompassing principle, but sometimes it is applicable that we say that the law of the land is the law. We have to figure out when is it that it is applicable, when is it that it is not applicable. So their starting point is that there's a distinction between a Jewish court sitting and deciding that it's going to adjudicate all matters according to civil law. That we would assume would be a breach of the Beit Din's responsibility towards Torah law. It might even be an application of the prohibition Rabbi Willig was speaking about, Eila mishpatim asher tasim lifnehem, as the Bible says, that the ordinances are supposed to be presented in front of Jewish law judges, for lo lifnei arkos, the Talmud says, not in front of secular courts, because that would be considered an insult. If two Jews brought their dispute in front of civil courts, it would be an insult to the divine system of law. It would be, as the Rambam, Maimonides writes, it would be like one is raising up their hand against the Torah that was given by Moshe Rabbeinu, the Torah that was brought down by Moshe. So sometimes this is also true if it's a Jewish court, but the Jewish court takes upon itself that it's only going to decide all cases according to secular law. Here, the parties are not going in front of the non-Jewish courts. They're going in front of Jewish judges. But if the Jewish judges decide upon themselves that they're only going to decide the case according to secular law, so that would be a violation on some level. This is what Avraham Yishaya Karolitz, the Chazon Ish, writes about Chazon Ish, very, very famous Jewish law authority, the early days of the Medina, of the establishment of the state in Eretz Yisrael. So he wrote that the establishment of the civil court system in Israel that was not under the aegis of rabbinical courts, even though all the judges might be Jewish, but if they accept upon themselves that they're only going to apply secular law, the legal system that was devised was based upon English law, is based upon Ottoman law, maybe Roman law, all kinds of legal systems, but not really Jewish law. So the Chazon Ish said, since it's not really premised upon Jewish law, it's based upon other secular legal systems, this is also a violation. This is a violation, he said, of the second part of what the Talmud says is prohibited, based on the verse that the laws and ordinances have to be placed in front of Lifnehem, in front of the Jewish law judges. So it says, Lifnehem, below Lifnehem, Yotos. It has to be placed in front of real judges and not a bunch of simpletons or fools. It should not be placed in front of people who are not proficient in Jewish law. So the question is that the Ramban, Nachmanides, in his commentary to the Torah, says that there's a difference between these two different aspects of the prohibition. When it comes to the prohibition of going in front of secular court, so even if both parties agree that they're going to appear before the secular court, that's not considered to be enforceable according to Jewish law. That's considered to be a condition that violates a ritual prohibition, which is not enforceable according to Jewish law. But if two parties agree that they're going to simply appear before Hedyotos, they'll appear before a Jewish tribunal, which is not so learned in Jewish law, so that is an enforceable condition. So how could the Chazon Ish say that this is not enforceable? So the answer is that generally speaking, if in an individual case you have parties that appear before three Jewish individuals who are not qualified judges, and they say, just use your common sense in order to arbitrate and decide the case, that's not considered to be flouting the authority of the Torah and an insult to the Torah that was brought by Moshe Rabbeinu. But if they appoint permanent judges and say to these permanent judges, even though they happen to be Jewish, we want you to decide all of your cases according to some secular law system as opposed to a Torah law system, so then, even though they're Jewish law judges, that also becomes an insult to the integrity of the Torah, because here, when you're establishing a Jewish justice system, you should establish a Jewish justice system that's going to operate according to the Torah and not according to secular law. I think this is the distinction in cases where parties make a contract, a stipulation, that they want the case adjudicated according to secular law. When is it enforceable? When is it not enforceable? So the Ramah, Moshe Isserles, in his commentary to the Torah, the Darkei Moshe, he quotes a statement of the Mordechai. You won't be able to find this necessarily in the Mordechai. It might be a paraphrasing of the Mordechai. It doesn't matter. It's the Darkei Moshe. That also counts. So the Darkei Moshe says that according to the Mordechai, as a general rule, we say, kol tanai shebemamon kayam, that every single monetary condition is considered to be enforceable. That happens to be a dispute in the Talmud between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda. We hold like Rabbi Yehuda that it is enforceable, but that's only when it's not for the purpose of being mafkia, the words of the Torah, when it's not for the purpose of repudiating the words of the Torah. People make a condition, they're not going to follow the Torah because they want a different set of condition, monetary conditions to apply to them. That's fine. The Mishnah says that if I'm watching an object of yours and I'm getting paid, I have a certain set of responsibilities. But if I make a condition with you that, for example, I'm going to show a socher, I'm going to be obligated if the object is stolen or lost, I make a condition that between you and me, I'm not going to be obligated if the object gets stolen or lost. That's considered to be a binding condition. That's perfectly fine. But if I make a condition for the purpose of negating the words of the Torah, I say that according to the Torah, I'm going to throw out this law from the Torah, so then the condition is not considered to be binding. This really is a distinction which is found in the Talmud itself. Talmud talks about a case where you have somebody who makes a loan. A lender makes a loan to the borrower. It's the seventh year of the Shemitah cycle. According to Torah law, all loans get canceled at the end of the seventh year. So if the lender makes a condition with the borrower, and he says, I'm making this loan, amanash lo tishmeteni shviyas, on condition that the Shemitah year is not going, the end of the Shemitah year is not going to cancel the loan. So then the Gemara says that this condition is null and void because you cannot negate what is written in the Torah. The Torah says that at the end of the seventh year, the loan becomes canceled. You can't say that the loan is not going to become canceled. However, if you just switch it around a little bit and you say that I'm making, the lender says to the borrower, I'm extending this loan to you, I'm menash lo tishmeteni bit shvius, on condition that you will not cancel your obligation to pay to me by virtue of the law of cancellation of loans, so then that is a binding condition. Why suddenly did that become a binding condition? Because here, the parties acknowledged the existence of the Torah law. I said, yes, according to the Torah law, the loan will be canceled at the end of the seventh year. But we're going to make a private deal that even though you don't have to pay me, but nonetheless, you, the borrower, are going to pay me, the lender, anyway, despite that cancellation. That would be a valid condition. This probably, although the matter is not without dispute, this probably is what is going at the heart of a dispute which is found within the commentaries to the Shulchan Aruch, to the Code of Jewish Law, between the Sma and the Taz. Seems that the Sma has a very broad-based position where he allows all kinds of conditions that sound a little bit suspicious. The Sma seems to say that if parties make a condition that they're going to adjudicate any dispute in civil court, if it's a certain right that a party would not have in Bezdin and would only have in civil courts, the Sma says, yeah, usually there's a prohibition to go to civil court, but if the parties agree to go, and this is the sort of remedy the person would only get in civil court and not in Bezdin, then that would be okay. That doesn't sound right. So the Taz jumps on the Sma, pretty much everybody else does as well, and it says, that can't be. Do you think that we're dealing with wicked people? We know that this is, as the Ramban says, this is a condition that's not considered to be a valid condition. It's null and void. Doesn't matter if the remedy is only available in civil court. So that can't be. But then the Taz goes further. And the Taz says that even if the parties agree that the rabbinical court, that they'll go to Beit Din, but the Beit Din will adjudicate the dispute in accordance with the civil law, in accordance with the not Torah law, but in accordance with the civil law. So that also is not going to be binding. So it sounds like the Taz says that you can't even make this type of condition. But that is in one place. The Taz says it in that particular formulation. That's in Siman Chabab in Shulchan Aruch. But then later on in Siman Samach Aleph, the Taz kind of explains himself a little bit more. I'm not going in detail through every single source because then we'd be here a lot longer than 40 minutes. But in this particular case, we'll turn to the Taz. The Taz says that the Vaday Koshe Enkan Isser im Osim Midah Shneim Kigon Shalotish Meteni Bishvius Alzech HaLakinyan. He says that if they're making a condition that's not going to be a repudiation of Torah law, this is source 10, going from the bottom of page 2 to the top of page 3, so then that would be okay. That would be okay. What's not okay is if they are stipulating to something which is an outright prohibition, such as going in front of the secular courts, or, as he really wrote earlier on in his criticism of the Sma in Siman Chabab, that would be Shelo Yishamet, where the parties make a condition that the loan simply will not be canceled altogether at the end of the Shemitah year. So the Taz really seems to accept the same distinction, that even when the Taz says that parties are not allowed to make a condition to have their dispute decided by Jewish law judges according to civil law, that seems to be talking about a case where it would be a repudiation of the Torah as opposed to a type of condition that people make all the time where they simply change around whatever their obligations would otherwise be. This comes up with respect to marital disputes. We might have a husband and wife, they enter into their marriage, law lovey-dovey, you sign a prenuptial agreement, okay, here's what happens if we get divorced, okay? People have to anticipate possible contingencies, things that could happen. That's why we have a ksuva. The ksuva that parties sign when they get married talks about how much the husband or his estate would have to pay the wife in the event of a death or divorce. So parties will sometimes enter into a prenuptial agreement. It's very much encouraged. by the Betin of America. They should sign a prenuptial agreement. There's ever a dispute about the giving of a get. We agree that we'll appear before the Betin of America, but they have an option. They don't only have to agree to submit the dispute about a get in front of the Betin of America. They can also choose to say any of our disputes. Let's say there's a dispute about the allocation of marital assets. Let's say there's a dispute about the amount of spousal support, a dispute about the amount of child support. We're going to place all of these disputes in the hands of the Betin. Then they have the option. According to the Betin agreement, they can say that we want the Betin to decide the case according to the law of equitable distribution, because that's what we are comfortable with. So the Betin of America thinks that's perfectly okay. That's not a repudiation of the words of the Torah. That's a case where the parties simply want to allocate a different set of obligations than that would have been the default proposition according to Jewish law. Just like the Mishnah says that somebody who is a paid watch person can stipulate that they're not going to be obligated in cases of theft or loss, despite the fact that according to the Torah, they would be required to do so. You don't have to rely solely on me. You know who says this? None other than the Minchas Yitzchak, Dayan Weiss, who's the head of the Haredi Beit Din in Jerusalem. Pretty good authority. So Dayan Weiss, if you look at source 11, says that this whole dispute between the Sma and the Taz, this is the second paragraph, he says that whole dispute discussed by the Sma and the Taz, to lo moel t'nai leilech le'arkos, that a condition to litigate a case in court is not considered to be binding as a matter of Jewish law, aval moel t'nai, but it would be a valid condition to say she'adunu lo dayanei Yisrael api mishpat arkos, to say in a particular case that the Jewish law judges will decide a particular dispute according to civil law. And he says it's not because we say that civil law is all-encompassing, not because civil law is always binding as a matter of Jewish law, then we would never decide cases according to Jewish law. But rather because of their condition, that was the nature of the condition in which they entered into their particular transaction or their particular situation. Now, is this allowed? Only if the parties simply say, like in the case of the shomer, the watch person, where the watch person stipulates, I know according to Torah law that I would be obligated in theft and loss, but I want to stipulate that I'm not going to be obligated, and the parties agree. But what if that happens to be consistent with the secular law? Happens to be consistent with the secular law. That somebody receives jewelry on consignment and his store is robbed, so that he's off the hook because it wasn't his fault that his store got robbed. But what if he put in the contract, not, we agree I'm not going to be responsible if the jewelry got stolen, but rather he said, we agree that we're going to follow secular law. And secular law happens to say that if the jewelry gets stolen, then he's not going to be obligated. Let's say. So, would this be worse if they specifically and explicitly reference secular law? Or is it that they should just say that we're going to follow the following set of rules, and that set of rules happens to be consistent with secular law? Does it make it worse if you cite secular law? So Rabbi Tzvi Spitz, who's a Dayan, I think in Israel, he's the author of the Minchas Tzvi, he's of the opinion that makes it worse. If you actually reference the secular law, you say, oh, we want to follow what the secular law says, that makes it worse. That's like stipulating that you're going to go to secular court. You have to say, let's say you want to govern your real estate transaction according to all of the real estate, all of the details and all of the provisions of a particular real estate statute. So let's say that real estate statute is 300 pages. So you append 300 pages to your contract of everything that statute says, and you just cut off the heading. The heading says, oh, this is from the real estate statute of the civil law. So you cut off the heading, the statute number, and you just say, I want to be bound by all these provisions. Rabbi Tzvi Gartner says, I don't really understand that. Either it's permitted to make the stipulation or it's not permitted to make the stipulation, but this really sounds like form over substance, and we have to focus on the substance. So Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, a famous great Dayan who lives in Eretz Yisrael, he was on the Bezdin Hagadol in Yerushalayim, the Supreme Rabbinical Court of Jerusalem, was Rav Menachem Goldberg advised the Beit Din of America that he thought it's perfectly permissible to say that the parties want, when they get married, for example, to have their dispute, should they ever get divorced, to have the allocation of marital assets divided according to equitable distribution law. So he says, really, it is no different from any case that is mentioned in the Talmud when people agree that they're going to accept upon themselves a different set of obligations. This also helps to explain what is a difficult, or important, I should say, Rashba. It's difficult because there are so many different interpretations of what the Rashba said. Rabbi Solomon ben Aderet, I have a long excerpt of his responsum at the bottom of page 4, source 5. It's in the Shailos HaTshuvos HaRashba, Chelek Vav, Siman Reish Nandalet, in which he seems to say contradictory things. The Rashba was talking about a case where a woman died shortly after she had gotten married. The father of the woman had provided a very nice dowry. Now the woman died, and she had a daughter. Unfortunately, the daughter died as well. And the question was, what happens to the money that the father had given to the married couple? So the general rule, according to the Torah, is that a husband inherits his wife. So the husband wanted to be able to inherit his wife. The father wanted his money back. And the father said, according to the secular law where they live, this is the rule. If the wife dies within the first year or so of marriage, there are no children. So then if the father of the wife had provided a generous dowry, he's entitled to receive it back. And the Rashba said, what's the big fuss? Even if you look in our Talmudic sources, you look in the Talmud Yerushalmi, people did this all the time. They stipulated, a husband would stipulate that he agrees that in that to be, at the time that he gets betrothed to his wife, before the marriage, he would agree that in the event that the wife would die within a year or so of the marriage and there wouldn't be any children, he wouldn't inherit the wife, and the money would go back to the father. So he said that this is something that we allow as well. So it sounds like the Rashba is comfortable with this type of stipulation. And he said, and if you live in a town where everybody does it that way, maybe we'll consider it as if there's an implicit condition. And then all of a sudden, he changes gears. And he says, oh, when we call makom, this is in bold, so it's easy to find on page 5. When we call makom, lino came ipneishu mishpah goyim. But if you're only doing this because you want to copycat the secular law, nearly she'asar, then all bets are off. Nefishim mechake es hagoyim, because then you are simply imitating the secular law of the non-Jewish judicial system. V'zeo shesira Torah lifneihem v'lo lifnei goyim, and then that becomes a violation of the prohibition of going in front of the Jewish law judges and not in front of the secular courts. So the simple reading of the Rashba, he started out saying it's perfectly fine, and then he said, oh no, this is a big problem. So the simple reading of the Rashba is that it all really depends on intent. The parties are doing it because this is the custom that they would traditionally follow between themselves. If this is that they're doing it because they think it makes sense and that's why they want to do it, that's perfectly fine. But if they're doing it because they just don't have faith in the Torah system of law, and they want to carte blanche, follow whatever it is that the secular law says, so that becomes a problematic. So it really then becomes an issue of figuring out what is the basis for the stipulation to follow civil law. There are numerous other ways to explain the Rashba. If you look in the Beis Yosef, that's the very bottom of page 5, carried over to page 6, it's Siman Vav. Beis Yosef seems to understand that the case the Rashba was talking about was where the stipulation was not simply to follow secular law, but even to go in front of the secular courts. And there are others that simply quote the second half of the Rashba, which is really very much a polemic against expanding the notion of the cases which are included in Dina de Malchus Dina, of what's the law of the land. But really, that's a separate discussion within the tshuva itself. That's why I have isolated it with a separate bold bold font in the middle of the page, on page 5, where it starts saying, Be'omer Ani, And that's really the main part of the Rashba that gets codified in Shulchan Aruch as a matter of halakha. So it could be, even if the Rashba says one can never make such a stipulation, it's not necessarily the case that we hold like the Rashba. It could also be that the Rashba was only applying this to cases where people were making conditions regarding inheritance, and maybe inheritance law is not considered traditional monetary law, but it's considered more in the realm of ritual prohibitions, as the Rambam writes. And it could also be, as Rav Ezra Basri writes, that the Rashba was really inveighing more against the notion of an entire community deciding that they're going to jettison the words of the Torah in favor of taking upon themselves a secular law regime, as opposed to parties in individual cases determining that this is the sequence of laws that they want applicable to themselves. So as a general rule, if it is determined that parties are making a condition because they're to follow civil law, not because they're valuing civil law over Torah law, but because the civil law is consistent with their general mode of conduct and transaction and custom, so then this really falls more into the second category of what would be permissible and appropriate cases for the Betin to incorporate the secular law, and that is the case of Minhag HaSochrim, where it happens to be the custom of the marketplace as well. And really the source for that is a Gemara in Bava Metzia, which we have on page 6, which says that if you have a mode of transaction called Situmta, not a normal mode of acquisition between two Jewish parties, but one which is introduced in the marketplace, so then that becomes binding as a matter of Jewish law as well. And the famous commentator Rabbi Akiva Eger says, based on this, that whenever there is a minhag hamakom, whenever there is a custom in a place that they follow within a certain industry, the custom of the marketplace, then one is obligated, if there is kivin de mamakom shenase or asik, this is source 23 on page 6, since in the place where the transaction took place, yeshmina nizdayin gepiderach hasochrim, there is a custom to follow the general way and practices of the merchants, velokefi dine Torah, not according to the Torah law, minag mevatel halacha. So then the custom becomes binding. It becomes binding instead of what the halacha would otherwise be. And that itself, curiously, perhaps paradoxically, that itself becomes incorporated into the halacha. So that the Beis Din needs to know what the customs of the industry and the marketplace are. But Moshe Feinstein even goes so far as to say that with respect to landlord-tenant rules. For example, you have a landlord that rents into a tenant in a rent-controlled building, and there are already rent control laws in place. So Moshe Feinstein says, even though the rent control laws were instituted by the non-Jews, and that is how this became the custom of how rentals are made in this building, since that is the custom, so we work with the assumption, even if it wasn't explicitly stated, that the parties intend to be bound by the rent control laws. That's even without regard to the principle of Dina de Malchusa Dina, just by virtue of the fact that this is the custom. And says Moshe Feinstein that since this is the custom, ain't sorry. This is source 31 on page 9. The custom doesn't have to be established only by the rabbis in the yeshiva. The gam af lo api yudim doesn't even have to be established by the Jews on the street. Even if this became the custom because this was a custom instituted by non-Jews, because of the fact that they're the majority of the population, then this becomes the custom and it is understood and implicit that all of the laws of rent control would apply to that transaction. For example, that the landlord wouldn't be able to evict the tenant at the end of the lease term if the tenant wanted to continue, and that the landlord wouldn't be allowed to raise the amount of the rent more than whatever is the statutory amount according to the rent control restrictions. That would also be incorporated into the halacha. So if you take a look at the Beis Din of America clause that we have in our prenuptial agreements, when parties choose to accept upon themselves that in the event there'll be a divorce, the Beis Din will decide according to equitable distribution principles, the way it's drafted is very carefully in compliance with all of these different considerations where we've avoided We've avoided just to be on the safe side. I'm not saying that it wouldn't be enforceable otherwise, but just to be on the safe side, an explicit reference to the secular law, and we've incorporated the fact that the parties are agreeing upon this because this is the general custom of dealing which they are anticipating in the course of their marital existence. Take a look at source 32, which is the only English one. The parties agree that the Beit Din of America is authorized to decide all monetary disputes, including division of property and maintenance, that may arise between them, and to utilize principle of equitable distribution in accordance with customary practice. Notice that turn of phrase. As the Beit Din deems appropriate, according to principles of Jewish law, equity, and local custom. So this way, there is a methodology for accommodating the wishes of the parties to have the transaction conducted according to secular law, but in a fashion which is not mafkia divrei Torah, which it does not repudiate the words of the Torah and does not repudiate the Torah system of justice. So the third category is dina demalchus dina. The law of the land is the law. So when do we apply that principle? When do we say that because there is a certain statutory law, even if it's not necessarily what would be called the custom of the merchants, even if it is not necessarily something that the parties made a condition to do, let's say the parties made a condition, they're going to go against it. They both agree they're going to go against the statutory law. When do we say that statutory law is binding upon the parties anyway? When do we apply dina d'malchus dina? So the Mamoshe Isserlis in the Shulchan Aruch, Simon Shin Samach Tes, says whenever it's the takanas b'nei amedina, whenever it is a broad sweeping economic regulation for the betterment of society in general. So what comes into that category? All of the posts can point out it's very difficult to classify and categorize exactly what fits in that category. But Moshe Feinstein writes in one place, there's a major mivucha, there's a major confusion about the parameters of the dina d'malchusa dina. So when do we say that it satisfies the bill? So here it would seem that whenever you have the situation that I mentioned earlier about, for example, where the government or the state laws say they're not going to enforce a Beit Din decision in child support, unless the Beit Din follows child support standards guidelines, this gives you a clue of when something is in dina d'malchus dina. When the government cares so much that they're going to be angry if two people privately contract to act in a way which is against the statutory regime. Generally, if I have two neighbors that make a decision, that make a contract between themselves, an agreement that they're going to allow certain uses of the property that might not be, technically speaking, permitted for one neighbor to do according to civil law, so the government doesn't care about that. You have a family that they arrange for the inheritance to be according to Torah law, not according to secular law. The government doesn't care about that. They have an agreement between two partners that their partnership is going to be governed according to principles of Jewish law. The government's not going to step in and say, no, no, we're not going to allow you to do that. So says Rav Moshe Feinstein in a different response, he says that you have to look and see whether it's a type of thing where if there was chiluke dinim, ben inchi leinchi, that if different people would privately contract to act differently with respect to a certain law, that it's going to lead to pandemonium. It's going to lead to a breakdown of the application of the economic regulation, and that the government is going to care. Rav Avadya Yosef quotes as well from the Chidah, from Rav Chaim Yosef David Azulai, a similar idea that it has to be a type of principle, v'imlo yikaimu, rivlo imoyim, that if it is not followed, so then the government's going to be very upset. They're going to crack down. So it would have to be something in that category. What's an example that Rav Moshe Feinstein feels falls into that category? So he says bankruptcy law. Speaks specifically about a case where a Jewish debtor goes bankrupt. There's a Jewish creditor who says, hey, under Jewish law, we don't have such a thing as bankruptcy. You still owe me the money. You have enough money to pay me. Maybe you don't have enough money to pay me and all of your other creditors, but just pay me. And then you'll deal with all of your other creditors separately. Says Moshe Feinstein, I think they would get really upset if you did that. It's called a preference. You're not allowed to do that according to secular law. You can't have a private contract between parties. The government's going to get really upset about it. So that falls under the category of Dina de Malchus Adina. And you figure out other types of things. If an arbitration tribunal would award child support without taking into account the child support standards guidelines, so then the government would get really angry and say, we can't enforce this decision. The Besdin would be able to issue an appropriate decision according to Besdin rules by incorporating the child support standards guidelines. So the Besdin then has an obligation to do so according to the principles of Dina de Malchus Adina. And the final aspect of where the secular law becomes relevant with respect to the Besdin proceedings is with respect to the procedural requirements of arbitration law. You know, the Torah says, Shaltim v'shaltrim titen l'cha b'chol shi'arecha. It's an obligation to establish rabbinical courts. It's a great thing. That's why we're here today, because we want to buttress the rabbinical courts. We think it's a very important system for the Jewish community to have. However, the verse says, Shaltim v'shaltrim. You have to have the judges, the courts, v'shaltrim. You also need to have the sheriffs and the police. You need to have the enforcement mechanism for the Besdin decisions to be enforceable in the civil courts. So therefore, it's very important that the Besdin incorporate into its arbitration proceedings, in order to ensure enforceability, the procedural requirements of secular law. Most of them are consistent with Jewish law anyway. You're not allowed to engage in ex parte communications with the parties. You have to allow the parties to present their case and their evidence in full. But some of them may be above and beyond. For example, that the parties must be allowed to be represented by legal counsel. According to Jewish law, not at all simple that the parties automatically are allowed to have legal counsel. However, according to secular law, this is a requirement, so therefore this becomes our requirement as well, because if we didn't do it, then the Besdin decisions would not be enforceable. Similarly, there are certain types of cases where in the Jewish law, if the parties appear in front of Besdin and say, yeah, we agree to abide by your decision, and to show you that we really mean it, we'll make a kinyan suda. We're going to raise a handkerchief or a pen. Here, we raise the pen. Now we're bound according to Jewish law. So if the Besdin would then issue a decision and one party wanted to enforce it, the court would say, we can't enforce that. We can't enforce a decision based on the raising of a pen. It just doesn't work. Kinyan suda doesn't work for us. It only works if you sign an arbitration agreement. So therefore, even when the Besdin would not technically otherwise require the signing of an arbitration agreement, usually nowadays it would anyway, but even when technically it wouldn't be required, it becomes required as a matter of incorporating the secular law into the halacha to ensure the fulfillment of Shoftim Mishotrim, Titen Lecha B'chol She'arecha, of being able to have Batei Din, rabbinical courts that issue enforceable decisions. So in summary, we have three different areas where the secular law can become incorporated into the halacha, into the adjudication of the Torah law that the Besdin is obligated to apply. One is Tanai Shemamon, where the parties make a condition that they want secular law to apply to their transaction. Very important, though, that it not be in a way which is machia, which is a repudiation of Torah law, like a system. We have Jewish judges who only apply secular law, for example. What would be an example of that? Parties get married, they say that in the event of divorce, we'd like the assets to be distributed according to principles of equitable distribution, according to common custom. Second, minhag ha'sochrim, whenever there is a practice in a particular industry, like, for example, when you have real estate transactions where people, as Rav Moshe Feinstein writes, it's understood that the custom is that parties don't buy real estate by just giving over cash, even though that might work as a matter of halakha. They have to sign a document, they have to give over a deed. Since this is the requirement that is followed by everybody, this is the custom, everyone understands that it's not going to be binding otherwise, so therefore that becomes binding as a matter of halakha. Third, Dina de Malchus Adina, when there is the law of the land, in cases of broad sweeping economic regulation, like bankruptcy laws, where the government would get really upset if people would privately contract around the law. Through having a healthy symbiosis between the age-old institution of Beit Din, of rabbinical courts, and the secular law, and an acceptance and proper application of the laws and processes that surround the Beit Din tribunal, it's my feeling that secular law, when employed properly and responsibly, can actually buttress and fortify the Betzin process, lahagdil Torah la'adira, to increase the splendor and the glory of the Torah system of justice. Thank you very much.